This is Ray Hananea with another podcast that I hope you will enjoy. Again, you can get information on all my podcasts at thedailyhookah.com. I'm Ray Hananea. Enjoy this one.
Cities in Michigan and Ohio, IVF has experts in all aspects of the field. As a founding member of IVF Michigan Fertility Centers, Dr. Nicholas Shama is one of the leading reproductive endocrinologists in Michigan and Ohio. Dr. Shama has performed over 10,000 IVF cases and has helped thousands of couples fulfill their dreams of parenthood. American board certified in both obstetrics and gynecology and reproductive endocrinology and infertility, Dr. Nicholas Shama is a very caring, compassionate, expert physician that understands not only the medical but also the emotional toil of infertility on his patients. When it's time, get personalized care from Dr. Nicholas Shama at IVF Michigan Fertility Centers in Michigan and Ohio. Call toll-free 855-952-9600, 855-952-9600.
And welcome back to TheArabStreet.org is our website, TheArabStreet.org. That takes you to all our podcasts. I don't know, we were having a little technical problems with Skype. But, oh, my gosh, you know, technology, it's not that great. But we're going to get him on the line. He'll be calling us, and we'll have our guest. Hassan Khatib is a lecturer of cultural studies and contemporary Arab studies at Birzeit University in the West Bank. He was previously the Minister of Labor and Planning for the Palestinian Authority, as well as the director of its government media center. I've asked him to call us directly, so as soon as he calls in, Michael, let me know, and then we can go talk to him about some of the events that are taking place in the Middle East. The Arab Street Radio is part of the U.S. Arab Radio Network, hosted by Leila Al-Husseini. I'll tell you, she puts in a lot of work every week, Monday through Friday, every morning. It's the only radio show that's broadcast every morning, each day. So Mike, our producer, just let us know that we have Hassan Khatib on the phone line. So, Hassan, thank you so much for calling. I'm very sorry about the little technical issues that we were having trying to connect. Welcome to the Arab Street Radio, which is being broadcast all over Detroit and, of course, online around the world. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hassan, tell me about you. You served, obviously, during the with the government, with the Palestinian Authority. You know, there was a time, you know, back in the 90s when everything looked so good. What happened? When we look back at everything, what really was the main thing that happened? Was it the murder of Rabin? Was it the rise of Israeli extremism? What has prevented peace from happening? Was it us? Was it our extremists? What do you think is the issue?
It's difficult to think of one single cause for this. I think there are many reasons, but people were optimistic immediately after signing the peace agreements with Israel.
Right.
And these were many agreements. It started with the Declaration of Principles and then the interim agreement. So it was a season of signing agreements, which made the public and actually the political elite, most of them at least, optimistic that finally there might be a way in which the Palestinian people can achieve their legitimate objectives of ending occupation and achieving freedom and statehood by peaceful means. However, soon after signing the agreements and the beginning of the implementation of the agreements, the Palestinians realized that they were unable to convince the Israelis that they should stop the expansion of settlement, because in the mentality of the Palestinian people, there is a contradiction between peacemaking and settlement expansion. Settlement expansion is about consolidating the occupation, while the peace negotiations is about ending the occupation, at least from our perspective.
Right.
The two cannot go together, and I think if you want one primary cause for the failure of the peace process, it's the insistence of Israel to continue expanding settlements in spite of the peace negotiations and the peace agreements.
Do you think that the resistance from them had to do with the same kind of issues that we face as Palestinians? There were many Palestinians who didn't like, you know, the deal. They didn't like the Oslo Peace Accords. Were the Israelis trying to make peace while winning over the support they needed, maybe, which is why maybe they continued to expand settlements? Or is this settlement drive so ingrained in Israelis, there is no chance for peace, that we can't stop them from doing it?
Yeah, I think there was a majority in Israel who thought that peace is possible, and all what is required is to give up the Israeli control over certain percentage of the Palestinian occupied territories, and then probably they can continue the expansion of settlements in some parts of the occupied territories. The problem is that Israel kept changing, especially in that period. And let's remember that in the election that took place in Israel 3 months after the assassination of Prime Minister Rabin by a Jewish terrorist at that time, brought about the Likud party, which voted in the Israeli Knesset a year ago against the Oslo Agreement.
Right.
So one should expect what would be the political behavior of the Israeli government headed by the party that was leading the opposition to that to these agreements. So I think the internal political dynamics in Israel played a very negative role, and gradually the Israelis started to realize that probably they can eat the cake and keep it in the same time. In other words, many of them started to realize that it might be possible for them to keep the land and to achieve peace while keeping the land in the same time.
Without agreeing to any kind of compromise. It seems that, do you believe that had Rabin not been killed, that we might have achieved peace? Because I think the Palestinian leadership, although there was a lot of resistance from the diaspora, there was obviously, we didn't have 100% support, but I think that they were strong enough to move forward with a peace agreement. Had he not been killed, do you think we would have had a peace accord that worked?
At least that was a possibility. But after his assassination, that became not a possibility. It became impossible. And it's not necessarily Rabin as a person, although that was an important factor. It's also that the public opinion in Israel was in support of the principle of land for peace. In the sense that the Israeli public or majority of it were willing to conceive the possibility of giving up the Israeli control over at least part of the Israel of the occupied territories. But there has been a continued radicalization in the Israeli society until we reached a point now where there is no longer a critical mass, neither in the Israeli public nor in the Israeli political elite, who is willing to entertain to any extent the idea of giving up the Israeli control over any part of the occupied territories.
And I think that creates a really dangerous situation, not just for Palestinians, but also for Israelis. But let me ask you one more question about Oslo. You know, of course, it was, 25 years ago that I was at the White House, and I remember the meetings, and I think you and I met briefly at the time there was so much optimism. It really was a great moment up until Rabin was killed, and then we could see everything falling apart. I personally blame the Israelis and Netanyahu for really doing everything, and Ariel Sharon. But the question I have for you is, today, 25 years later, we have all these people saying Oslo was a mistake, it could never work, the fact that it failed proved that it was a bad idea. this very same people who criticized Oslo were the very ones who rejected Oslo. They didn't want, you know, there were Palestinians too that, you know, that engaged in suicide bombings to block peace, that engaged in violence, that attacked the Palestinian Authority. We had our side that was also trying to prevent peace. You know, don't we? I know, obviously, we're the subjugated people, and the Israelis actually have a country, a state, and a system. But those people today, aren't they being a little, you know, shallow or misleading in saying that Oslo was a failure because of what it contained, rather than being a failure because of the rejection and opposition that it faced from Israelis and Palestinians?
If Oslo is a failure, then we have to ask the following question. What made Oslo failure?
Right.
The answer is Israel. So the problems, there might be certain defects in Oslo, and I will come to that in a minute. But Oslo was a breakthrough that was accepted by the two sides and the two respective public opinions and the whole international community. So it was a historical opportunity, except that Israel started to change and to deviate from the principles of Oslo. But Oslo included certain holes and problems and mistakes. And I think from our perspectives, Palestinians, the main mistake in Oslo is that it did not include clear commitments by Israel to stop the expansion of settlements. It should have included clear indication that Israel, by this agreement, is committed not to continue the expansion of settlements. And I remember that Dr. Haider Abdeshafi, the head of the Palestinian delegation to Washington negotiations, did not like that agreement, particularly for this purpose. And he said that we can live with everything else, but the two sides should have included this aspect in the agreement, because this agreement, this point, can be a spoiler to the whole agreement, and he proved to be correct.
And you know that I personally disagree with the, you know, complaints from people that say, oh, trying to make peace, you know, with Israel will never work. I mean, if we give up the concept of Oslo, what do we have left? What's the alternative? There really doesn't seem to be an alternative, except one where we live in continued limbo. And, you know, obviously we're not going to go away. You're not going to go away. I'm not going to go away. Maybe 40 years from now we'll both be gone. But we have children. We have memories. We have a movement. That doesn't seem to be weakening. But what do we have left if we don't have a peace process? And do you think that there is a way to get back? You know, although it just seems almost impossible, but is there a way to get back to a point where we can compromise with Israel?
We might be able to come back into another point where we can probably start to work out a different deal. But that would require two factors. The first one is some kind of a reversal to the radicalization trends that has been happening in Israel, because Israel that we have now is no longer Israel that we negotiated with 25 years ago. And second, the United States, because United States is also to blame for the failure of this process, because they never held Israel accountable to its violations, not only to international legality and to the rights of the Palestinians, but also to the agreements themselves. United States was too biased to Israel to understand that it encouraged Israel, actually, to behave in a way that disregarded the spirit of the agreement and the letter of the agreement. So we need meaningful mediation and third party, and we need changes in Israel that would allow a common ground that doesn't exist now at all.
I want to come back to the point about the United States, but first I want to ask you about us as Palestinians. Did we do anything? I mean, I can't believe that, you know, when I look at compromise, sometimes we have to accept the reality of the truth, and sometimes the truth is not easy to take. Were we responsible in any way for the collapse of the peace process? What was our role? Besides, you know, right. Hey, we didn't like this one aspect of the settlements. Did our people, like, you know, the Hamas segment, you know, and suicide bombings, did that not embolden the fanatics in Israel to push even harder and use that to stop the peace? They were going to stop it anyway, but didn't we make it easy for them to stop the peace process?
We also made mistakes. We made mistakes during negotiations, mainly when we allowed certain defects in that agreement. But we also made mistakes during the implementation. The performance of the Palestinian Authority when the authority was established was not very much successful, and that contributed to a growing gap between the public and the leadership, and also the bad performance of the Palestinian leadership as a government enabled Hamas to cultivate the gap between the public and the leadership and to grow popularity on the basis of opposing both the agreement and the authority that was established by that agreement. And then these very violent activities that started to take place by Hamas also contributed to and gave justifications to Israeli withdrawal from certain commitments. And it also contributed to the radicalization process in Israel. The same way the Israeli settlement expansion contributed to radicalization in Palestine. And here comes the again, the problem of the performance of the third party, because the third party did not do anything to try to break this vicious circle whereby Israeli behavior is radicalizing the Palestinian public, and the Palestinian behavior, or some of it, is radicalizing the Israeli public. That vicious circle continued until the Second Intifada in 2002, where the peaceful relations between the two sides was replaced by fierce violence by the two sides.
My guest on the line is Ghassan Katib. He's a lecturer in cultural studies and contemporary Arab studies at Bir Zeit University, one of the great universities of the West Bank. And Ghassan, years ago, when I was very young, I was encouraged by Ibrahim Abulughad to become involved in the Palestinian activism, although I probably would have. He nurtured, you know, my focus on media and communications, and I don't know if you worked with him. I know he passed away a while ago. But he did teach at Bir Zeit University. So Bir Zeit has a very special place in my heart, along with everything in Palestine. But let me ask you this other question, Ghassan. I know this is a tough question to answer for Palestinians, because we're at the receiving end of the conflict. You know, the Israelis, they have like a double life. They enjoy their life within their little apartheid-like cube, and then the rest of it, they go out and they punish us. They don't feel the same suffering that we feel. But isn't there two communities in the Palestinian community, one that accepts compromise and one that doesn't accept compromise? And is that a problem for us to achieve statehood? Or do the people that support compromise, should we just give up and say, okay, there is no chance for compromise, let's keep fighting for total recovery of Palestine, which I don't believe can ever happen. But doesn't that exist, this two, we have like a two-state existence in the Palestinian community? or do you think I'm off base?
No, first of all, I want to thank you for praising Birzeit University, and I just want to say that I happen to be teaching now in an institute that carries the name of Dr. Ibrahim Abulughod, Institute of Ibrahim Abulughod Studies.
Wow, he was such a good person. He was a good man.
Yeah. But back to your question, Palestinian society is a pluralistic society, and it should be natural to expect that society to have different views over anything, actually,
right.
Especially a tough agreement like, or a significant agreement like Oslo Agreement. It was controversial, but the Palestinian people at a certain point of time were disagreeing in a democratic way. And we had election, and those who did not like the leadership that signed the agreement and did not like the agreement voted in certain way, and the majority voted in a different way. And at the end of the day, we elected Yasser Arafat as a president, and we elected 130 members for a parliament, which was the first ever parliament for the Palestinian people. And we started to have a lively democratic political life, and that was a very impressive beginning. And these elections were witnessed by many prominent personalities, and the monitoring team from the international community was headed by ex-president Jimmy Carter, and everybody was happy with that. And later, we also had a second election after the death of Yasser Arafat, which also went in a democratic way, except that it was won by Hamas, which is to a certain extent similar to what happened with Israel, in Israel after the assassination of Rabin, when the opposition party to the peace process won that election. So having differences over the agreement by itself was not a problem. The problem was that the Palestinian society could not keep these democratic differences and fall in internal non-democratic kind of relations, which is something that we need to blame ourselves for. But also maybe we can blame some external parties that was feeding these internal difficulties within Palestine. And I can name countries like Iran and Syria at that time. But at the end of the day, we are responsible for not being able to maintain the democratic way of managing our internal differences over that agreement.
Let's go back to the United States for a question. You were pointing out that, I mean, even during the Oslo peace process, the American government really wasn't objective or fair to us. They were supporting Israel, and obviously it's about politics. I get it. But we have a president today who's so mercurial, who's unpredictable, controversial. He's done horrible things. In terms of Palestinians officially recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, even though de facto Israel was running and controlling Jerusalem, whether we put a label on it or not. He's doing everything to support Israel. But in my mind, all he's doing is what past presidents have done without the happy face. You know, Bill Clinton and all his promises, when I look back at it, there had to have been some kind of flaw. I just don't believe that it was a genuine concern for Palestinians. He was concerned with bringing about peace that Israel would accept, and I don't think he was that great. Now, Trump is unpredictable. I think he's thrown the game board up in the air. He's caused such disarray. Isn't that an opportunity for us, for the Arab world, to rally together and stand up as one voice? Wouldn't somebody like that, wouldn't you think, someone like Donald Trump would force the Arabs to come together and say, hey, let's set aside our differences and stand up to Israel. But instead, the Arab world is nothing. Trump exposed, it seems, he exposed the fact that the Arab world is weak, that the Arab world is in total disarray more than the Palestinians. And it's just, I don't know where we're going to go from here other than to hunker down and hope that something changes. What do we do?
Well, we have to remember that the election of Donald Trump came after 4 to 5 years of really difficult political reality in the Arab countries because of these internal events that started with protests by the public against the failure of the Arab regimes to achieve either democracy or economic development. But then, as you know, these protests turned to be something like civil wars. And without going into the details of that, the Arab world was in really terrible situations when Donald Trump took over. And the Gulf states were worried that the previous administration was taking some kind of attitude that they were not happy with vis-a-vis Iran, especially after signing an agreement between Iran and the West, Europe and the United States. So when Trump came with attitude that is too hostile to Iran, some of the Arab Gulf states thought that this is the way out. And that they have to join forces with this new president against their common enemy, Iran. And therefore, he, in this policy, contributed to further divisions of the Arab countries. And therefore, what you suggested of rallying together against Trump is not realistic, unfortunately. Right. And the different Arab causes, including the Palestinian cause, which is an Arab cause, is suffering from the new reality in the Arab world and the new relation between some of the Arab countries and the United States.
Are we also suffering? There seems to be a rise in religious, you know, identity over secular identity. You know, I'm Arab. I'm a Palestinian. You know, Ibrahim Abulhad used to say this all the time. We're not Christian. We're not Muslim. We're not even Jewish. You know, my wife happens to be Jewish. Jews and Arabs get along very well in reality.
Right.
But they're, now I feel like sometimes, you know, as a secular Arab, that I'm not part of the Palestinian movement, which has become religious, or there's no hope with the Israeli movement, which has become very religious too. Is that a danger, or is that just an aberration that is a consequence of the failure of peace?
No, this is dangerous because the different conflicts, including the Palestinian, but other conflicts in the regions, are taking some sort of religious nature. Look at the Sunni-Shiite conflict and look at the Islamic radicalization in the Arab countries and look at the Jewish fundamentalist radicalization in Israel, because Israel now seems to be run by Jewish fanatics rather than the previous secular leadership that was able to gain respect in the world in general for that purpose, whether we like it or not. So the radicalization, the ideological radicalization and the religious fundamentalism that is rising in all levels is one of the major dangers that are facing the region in general, and it's responsible partially for taking us into all this bloodsheds that are happening all over the region.
Ghassan, is your time tight, or can you hang on for a few minutes?
Or I think, yeah.
We might be pushing it. Let me ask you a final question then, and I'll let you go.
Yeah.
Two questions. One, what do you think needs to be done? And two, how can we as Palestinians and Arabs help you, Birzeit, and the Palestinians back home? What needs to be done, and how can we help you? What can we do? What should we be doing?
Yeah, first of all, we need to make efforts in order to have some kind of unity over our priorities.
So we have to come together.
Right. We have to come together. We have to identify specific messages, specific objectives that all Palestinians will work for, each in their reality and positions, because we have presence everywhere. We have presence in Arab countries. We have presence in Israel. We have presence in the United States. And if we take advantage of the strength of the presence of Palestinians everywhere, especially that now by time, we're having people, influential people, actually. We're not only numbers in these different countries in the world. We are also quality. And this is developing rapidly, and we can be influential. So if we can, in order to make a difference, we need first to be able to develop agreed-on political positions and objectives and messages. That is the first and most important objective. Probably the second is to try to find ways to strengthen the grassroots movements all over the world that is trying to hold Israel responsible for its violation of the rights of the Palestinians. In both the grassroots level, example of this is the BDS movement,
right?
Or in the international and diplomatic level, where the PLO is supposed to be more active in holding Israel accountable for its violations to the international law, in the different international agencies, and in accordance with the international law.
Do we need another Yasser Arafat, do you think? And is there anyone like that on the horizon?
We need bringing life back to the PLO.
Yeah.
That itself will bring about the right person and persons. But we need to revive the PLO, because it is the framework that can allow us to develop these agreed-on objectives, messages, tactics, etc.
I want to thank our guest, Ghassan Khatib. He's a professor at Birzeit University. He published a book, Palestinian Politics and the Middle East Peace Process, Consensus and Competition in the Palestinian Negotiation Team. Is there a website, Ghassan, where you write, where people can go to follow your thinking at all, that you want to mention?
I write regularly in a website called jmcc.org.
Got it. Yes, it's a great organization. And I will make sure that
we also publish public opinion studies in that website as well.
www.jmcc.org. Ghassan Khatib. Ghassan, be safe. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning here on the Arab Street Radio in Detroit and the United States. Thank you.
Thank you, and good luck.
You too. Bye. Thanks, Ghassan. This is Ray Hanania here at the Arab Street. We're going to take a quick break, catch up with our programming, and we will be right back right after these messages.
LIFE is a nonprofit charity that's provided humanitarian aid and development to people and communities for over 25 years, regardless of race, color, religion, or cultural background. When disaster occurs here or around the world, LIFE for Relief and Development rushes in to provide food, medical aid, and shelter to those in need. Please help improve these efforts. Make your tax-deductible donation to LIFE now at lifeusa.org or call 248-424-7493.
بتعرفوا شيء؟ احنا كتير بنهتم بالمقبلات بالاكل الشامي،
واحنا بنهتم بالبهارات والتسبيكة في الاكل المصري،
واحنا نهتم هواية باللحوم وجودتها بالاكل العراقي، واحنا في مطعم عشتار نهتم بكم، اعتمدوا علينا. ايا كان، نحن في عشتار نعرف ان لكل مذاق اسرار، فنحن نقدم اجود انواع اللحوم من ملحمة عشتار الواقعة على 56865 راين رود.
عشتار، قصة حضارة ترويها لكم اطباقنا المميزة في كل زيارة.
تفضلوا بزيارتنا في 3625 ايست 50 ميل رود ستين هايتس.
مطعم عشتار بإدارة فادي بهنام وعلي البغدادي. 586-698-2585.
When you're looking for the best in optical care, Dr. Imad Nakash is your doctor to see. With years of experience and thousands of successful procedures performed, you can trust your eyes to Dr. Imad Nakash. See Dr. Imad Nakash and his professional staff for your eye care needs. There's two locations to serve you. In Hazel Park, call 248-336-3937. 248-336-3937. In Rochester Hills, call 248-299-3937. That's 248-299-3937.
The Rama Relief Foundation provides humanitarian aid into areas inside of war-torn Syria, as well as aid to the refugees who have fled to the neighboring countries in the Middle East. The foundation offers food baskets, container shipment, mental health, education, soup kitchens, and more. Go to ramarelief.org or call 248-990-4247. Any donation amount made to Rama will go to sustaining many lives. Call now 248-990-4247.
Ziad brand. Quality products from our family to yours. Ziad Brothers Importing offers the finest quality products, including brands like Sultan, Kraft, Nestle, Puck, Rico Picon, Donna, and many more. Ask your retailer to carry these fine products because you deserve the very best. For more information, visit our website at www.ziad.com. That's www.ziad.com. Ziad, quality products from our family to yours.
And welcome back to the Arab Street Radio. I'm Ray Hanania here at WNZK AM 690. Our phone number is 248-557-3300. If you want to call in, we had a little bumpy start this morning, you know, because this technology, you know, the more technology we have, the worse it gets. It was so much simpler when I only had three channels on my TV set. Channel 2, channel 5, channel 7. That's all. I didn't need to choose. Or I go to a restaurant and I had a simple menu. Today I go to a restaurant, there are 900 choices on the board. I don't know what I'm going to eat. I got to waste my time trying to figure out what's happening with all the stuff they're throwing at me, all the technology, all the computers, all the choices. It's very disturbing. And then on top of it, we have this painful failure of the peace process, the destruction of the Middle East, the conflicts that continue to rip the place apart, the extremism of Israel, the horrible conditions all over. It's just disturbing. Probably the most disturbing story, though, this past week was the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi dissident and the columnist who, by the way, you know, it's interesting, he was hired by the Washington Post after he started criticizing Saudi Arabia. The Washington Post wouldn't hire him when he was with the government, you know, because the Khashoggis have been very close to the prior Saudi leadership. And that's always the problem with the mainstream American news media. They're such hypocrites. They look for anything hateful or critical of the Arab world, and they promote it. And if you have been thrown out and you're an angry voice against the Arab world, the way Jamal Khashoggi was, the Washington Post will reward you because their newspaper is so biased, so one-sided, so terrible. You know, I subscribe to the New York Times, and I'll tell you, it just makes me shiver at the bias in the reporting, the one-sided aspect of the media when they read this. And of course, the New York Times censors me. You know, I pay. You know, I'm a paid subscriber to the New York Times, and I comment on articles, and they won't publish my comments. You know, because they don't like the criticism. They do not like the news media today. Is as bad as they say the Trump administration is. They're no better. And I think as an Arab American, that's disturbing, because really, the people that should be fighting for freedom against censorship and justice are actually engaged in it, the news media, in a different way. This whole Jamal Khashoggi issue, though, is disturbing, that he visits the Saudi embassy in Turkey and in Ankara. And he goes to get a document. He goes into the Saudi embassy in Turkey, and he never comes out. And the rumors and the stories, of course, we don't have the facts, but the rumors and the stories are that he was killed, possibly intentionally killed, or possibly they were trying to drug him so they could kidnap him and whisk him back to a prison in Saudi Arabia. And that apparently he died of an overdose. And worse, the stories that they dismembered him. You know, it's a very sickening thing. There is no way that any of this can be justified. And you have to wonder, are we our own problems? These countries in the Middle East, are we bringing it on ourselves? How can we be better when this happens? It's very depressing. Let's go to the phone lines. I think, I don't know, Mike, we have Jerry on the line. He's been holding. He wanted to say hello.
Yes.
Hey, Jamal? Or
Jerry should be on.
Yes, sir.
Oh,
yes,
Jerry, sir. There you are. Okay. I'm going to call you Jamal, okay, Jerry?
Yes, good morning.
What's your Arab name, Jerry? What's your real Arab name?
Najib Habba.
Najib. All right, Najib. We're only going to go full Arab this morning. Najib Habba. Go ahead, Najib.
I'm Najib Habba, and you are?
Yeah, I don't have an Arab name. They gave me this American name, Raymond. Raymond. I would love to be called Abdullah.
Yeah, you are Raymond Yusuf Hananiya, right?
I want to be Barack Hussein Hananiya. Or... So how are you doing, Jerry?
Pretty good. Thank you, Ray, and thank you for taking my call, and thank you for...
Thanks for waiting.
Mr. the Professor...
Ghassan Khatib, he's a good guy.
Yeah, was listening, and he highlights a lot of spots on the Palestinian history. Ray, first of all, about the journalist, Mr. Jamal Khashoggi, I do believe that's what happened, Ray.
Yeah.
A journalist tried to be honest.
Yes.
And did he stand against the regime?
Yes.
Tried to make his, they shut him up.
Yes.
But I wish him good luck, and I hope he's okay.
I don't think he is. I think this is terrible. It's just very disturbing. You know, we make ourselves look bad.
Exactly.
It's bad enough the way we look in the world from our enemies, you know, the haters in Israel, the haters in, you know, other areas, the haters in the United States. And then we have this, and it's like, okay, it's frustrating.
You see, this is a problem we are facing in the Israel. There is no such a honest and true generals in the Middle East. When they try to say the truth...
Yes.
Someone will sue them behind the bars.
Well, here's a guy. Listen, Jerry, this is a guy who was a supporter of the government in Saudi Arabia and celebrated his power. He was close to the other kings, you know, the other brothers, wealthy, rich. And I guess, is that what Arabs are, that when we're in power, it's okay to be mean and bad? And then when we're out of power, then suddenly we become righteous, you know, crusaders.
That's the reason what happened to us happened because of those negative things in our society in the Middle East.
Yes.
All right, let me ask you a question. Yes. Is Mr. Jamal Khashoggi related to Mr. Adnan Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia?
I think it's part of the same family.
Right. I come to, not trying to change the shift to the
That's all right, go ahead.
History. All right. There was a lot of former prime minister in Israel, started from Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Rabin, Golda Meir, Ariel Sharon, and now the king of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. I call him the King David, the new King David.
Oh, that's too nice for him. He doesn't deserve that. Guy's a serial killer.
Yeah, except two, a former prime minister, Yitzhak Rabin and Ehud Barak.
Right.
My question, Ray, I do remember Mr. Yitzhak Rabin, he did start the peace negotiation in Oslo. And you know, Ray, I'm telling you a secret.
Yeah.
I have the original answer from Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. When he became prime minister, I sent him a letter in the 90s to open a peace negotiation with the Palestinian. And, right, the answer came to me in 3 days.
Wow.
And I still have the original letter.
That's phenomenal.
Yes, sir.
Still, you know, he was, I don't agree with everything, you know, he did, but he was a courageous person to try to make peace. For the Israelis.
I spoke to his widow, Miss Leah Rabin, and I give her my sympathy when he was killed by some Jewish Orthodox extremists.
A Netanyahu follower. Listen, you got to say it real quick because we only have a few minutes.
Right. Don't you think the Palestinians, they lost a lot of opportunities?
Yes, we did.
With the Israeli, they were trying to give them the solution of the two states. But it was rejected by the Palestinians.
That's part of it, but I think...
They lost a good chance.
Listen, Jerry, thank you. First of all, thank you for calling. But yes, I agree, except I really think the Israelis didn't want it either. They stopped it. They rejected it. They blocked it. I mean, Hassan Khatib pointed out that they continued to build settlements, you know, while they were doing all this. Let's take a real quick call from Ahmed, who was kind enough to call in. Ahmed, thank you so much for calling in. Go ahead, you got a couple minutes. Hi, Ahmed.
Hey.
Good morning.
Hi. I would like to call you Abdullah.
Yes, that's what I want to be called, but what am I going to do?
I'm going to call you Abdullah now on. Ray, listen, do you think Saudi Arabia killed Jamal Khashoggi?
I think that he was killed in the Saudi embassy. But then again, listen, I have no proof, right? No one has any proof. Because if there was proof, but he did go in there, and you think in an embassy, correct, that they have all these cameras, all this security, it's impossible to disappear. And if he did leave, why wouldn't they show the video of him leaving, right? So I have to believe that chances are he never left that building, at least alive. That's disturbing, isn't it? It's very disturbing.
And after that, we will go from there.
Yeah.
Thank you, Abdullah.
All right. Thank you, Ahmed. I appreciate it. Ray Hanania here. Abdullah Hanania. Yeah, that's what I'll call myself, Abdullah Hanania. You know, they go, oh, you're Christian. You can't say Abdullah. Are you kidding? My cousins, my relatives, Abdullah is a very popular name in the Hanania clan. So it's not unusual. And, you know, Allah... Abdullah means servant of God. Abdullah, Abid Allah. Allah is a Christian word for God. You know, it's not some foreign, you know, Islamic word. Muslims use it too. But I hate it when people come up to me and they go, oh, yeah, the Muslims are taking over the Arab world. Like, are you kidding? I said, you know, what's happening in the Arab world is that we're destroying ourselves and we're not really doing enough. We should be taking advantage of Donald Trump. Instead, we're in total disarray. Everything that he does, we should be outraged over it, but instead of making us outraged, we just fall over. Anyway, listen, thank you, everybody, for listening. I'd like to direct you to one column, one story that I wrote, if you go to thearabdailynews.com. One gleam of hope and bright light of the federal court in Arizona blocked the anti-BDS law that punishes critics of Israel in Arizona. And the judge there, Diana Homotua, who happens to be Native American, imposed the substance of law and rejected the law that says that if you boycott Israel, you can't get any money from the state of Arizona. That law has been passed in 25 states, and two of them have turned it away. And that's a gleam of light and hope for us that we can turn back this pro-Israeli fanaticism that has been building up here in the United States. I'm Ray Hanania. You can go to thearabstreet.org, thearabstreet.org, get all the information from that website. I want to thank Mike for his patience this morning. We had a rough start with the radio show. I'll be back in the second week of November for a radio show here, second Friday, to do our show. But you can always listen to my podcast by going to thearabstreet.org. I have several guests coming up, including Larry Durfner and other people over the next few weeks. I'm Ray Hanania. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. This is Ray Hanania. I want to thank you for listening to my podcast here at thedailyhookah.com. You can always reach me online or by email. I'd love to hear your thoughts.